Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 7, delivered on September 15, 2010. The title of this lecture is Financial Ratios.
Today, financial ratios. I caution that we will be using accounting information, and I have already talked about the limits on accounting information. So we do always have to look at this with a little bit of a jaundiced eye, to the extent that not all costs are going to be captured. But certainly we get some interesting windows on companies, especially as we compare financial ratios from year to year on a company, and also as we compare the financial ratios of a company to its industry. And I will talk more about that, because neither of those is always the best idea, especially comparing a company to its industry in terms of ratios. Sometimes one company's ratios can be different from the industries, but that's because most of the companies in the industry suck, quite honestly. So just because the ratios of one company are not the same as those or near those of another of other companies isn't in and of itself some dire thing. But I begin by talking about the five broad categories of ratios, the first of which is near and dear to my heart. And how the heck do I get this stupid screen to... Oh, well, let me just get this screen up here. Bear with me one moment here. I want to get this screen out of my way here so I can actually do work. System. Forgive me for this. I'm trying to get this screen out of my way so I can actually teach in this class. Okay. There. To this day, no matter how long I teach here, I can't figure out how to get that thing up. First and foremost on the list of the categories of ratios are the profitability ratios. Those are the ones that would probably be the quickest to be wanted by some financial analysts who didn't know much about financial analysis. But the profitability ratios are useful. Just to capture some basic information about a company, and I'm going to check something here because there's a term, I want to caution you, I'm going to use terminology that is a little bit different in a couple of cases from what you will see in the textbook, and I'm going to have to be a check here one thing here very quickly. I'm also going to be showing you a couple of ratios that are not the same as the textbook's ratio, that are not included in the textbook. But, well, I'm not going to see that here, so let me just write it up here. Take my chances that I'm using the same terms here. Gross margin. Gross margin. Sales over gross profit. Or gross income, I should say. Let me do the technically the way the book writes it. Sales over gross income. That's your gross margin. Essentially, that one captures the percentage of your revenues that are being eaten up by the actual direct expense of the goods you're producing. What percentage of your revenue is being eaten up by the goods you're producing? One thing that I did want to point out, though, is that there is no golden number. It will be very different from one industry to another, the gross margin will, as will all of these ratios. There are no golden ratios here at all in here. And I'm thinking, do they use the word sales or do they use the word revenue in the book? I wish I knew which one they did, but I don't know. Okay, nonetheless, doesn't matter one way or the other. Okay. Now, the other one that is a big profitability ratio is the net margin. And when I say sales, that would be the same as revenue. Net margin would be sales over net income. Am I writing that? No, I'm writing that backwards. That's why I'm all confused. God, gross income over sales. Sorry about that. I was so confused because I was looking at that and I knew something was wrong. And then it would be for the net margin, would be net income over sales. Whew. Now I've got it right. And again, these two ratios, I'll talk about a little about net margin. Now I've seen, and you will see possibly in the next few days or the next few weeks, you'll see net margins that will range anywhere from as high as maybe 15, 20% on down to as low as maybe less than 1%. And there is nothing defective about that company that's got a net margin that's less than 1%. I recall many years ago, during the OPEC oil embargo and the time after that when gasoline prices first went very high, shocking people, that one of the oil companies went on television with advertisements, and this executive of the company was trying to explain, you know, that of our sales, for a dollar of sales, our profit is less than one penny of that dollar. Our profit is less than one penny of that dollar. And, of course, a lot of people didn't believe him. Yeah, you're lying through your teeth. Well, no, that would actually be the case in some industries. But in an industry like oil, where you're selling billions and billions of dollars, literally tens of billions or hundreds of billions, a penny or so of profit on each dollar of sales is still a staggering amount of money. Another good example of this would be if you think about companies, have any of you ever gone to a Dollar Tree store? Yeah, I go to places like that because I'm cheap. I won't go to Aldi's. I hate Aldi's because they throw your damn food on the floor in boxes, and I hate that. And they make you pay a quarter to rent a cart, which pisses me off. But no, seriously, noobs. If you go in there and they want you to pay a quarter, you know, really, do I look? Well, okay, some of the people in here do look like they'd steal the carts. But if you think about a place like a Dollar Tree, how much in sales do they make in a day, and how much could possibly be profit in one of those stores? You think about it, you know, there's never a lot of people in there. Maybe the average person buys $8 worth of stuff. They might have 20, 30, 40 customers a day. How could they possibly stay in business? Obviously, they have to pay the workers, minimum wage, of course, but they have to pay lights and all that. How could they possibly stay in business? Their margins, both of their margins have to, well, certainly their net margin has to be very low. If they had that kind of sales figures and they have to pay all those bills, how would they possibly stay in business? Well, in fact, they do magnificently, those kinds of stores do. Because you think about it, suppose that one store like that, one store on a daily basis might pull $20 in net income. $20, that's all. But what would that mean if you had 1,000 of those stores in the country? That'd be $20,000 a day in net income times, let's say, about 360 days of work operations a year. Oh, then it turns into a multi-million dollar business, even though you have pathetic net income and it would look ridiculous as a net margin. The companies are still fabulous. Companies like Aldi's, they have investors love those companies because even though they have such small margins, they still are hugely successful because there are so many of the stores. And if you think about the diversification of the stores, even if 1, 2, or 50 or 100 of the stores all blew up in one day, it would hardly even dent the profitability of the company overall for the day. So those are great kinds of stores, even though you would see net margins that are ridiculously low. So just because a net margin is low is not an indication that the company is in some kind of dire straits at all. It might very well be doing quite well, thank you, on it. But anyway, the profitability ratios are kind of interesting, those two. But you get into some other ones that are even more. Return on assets. This is a profit return on assets, which we call ROA. Now, ROA is your net income. Now, wait a minute. I've got to be careful because I don't know if they use the term profit or income in the book, but I just want to make sure that I'm not going to throw you for a loop with it. Net income. Okay. Net income over total assets. Net income over total assets. This essentially tells you how much money per dollar you're extracting from your assets, how hard those assets are working for you. So if you had, let's say, $5 million in total assets and your net income was $500,000, in a very real way, those total assets, your total asset base, had earned 10% return. Once you think of it that way, then you ask yourself more of an economics question. Okay, is 10% a reasonable rate of return for those assets that we have in place on the balance sheet? In other words, is that a reasonable return for the opportunity cost of those total assets being used for what they're being used for? The buildings, essentially the plant and equipment, the buildings, the computers, the physical hardware of the company. Is that a reasonable return for that? And as an investor, you would ask yourself, could that money that is in those total assets have earned more at about the same risk? So you're thinking of this in terms of almost like the company has invested this amount of money, the total assets. Its net income is that amount of dollar return. So the dollar return divided by the total value of the dollars you invested is your return on asset. Was that a good deal? That's how you think about that one. And then there's the return on equity, the ROE. I'm being a little careful here. Return on equity. This one is net income over shareholders' equity. Total shareholders' equity. I'm just going to write as shareholders' equity here. This one asks a similar question, except that this one is pinning to the investors. For the money that the owners have in this company, for the money that the owners have at stake in this company, are they getting a good return? And by good return is, could they get a better return based upon the same risk with that money that is in the company? So if I were to tell you that the shareholders' equity in the company was $1 million, and what did I say before? A $500,000? Well, that's a little ridiculous. Let's try something else. So if I told you that the shareholders' equity in the company was, let's say, $1 million, and the net income of the company was $50,000, that would be a 5% return on the owner's money. on the owner's money, what the owners can claim as theirs. Then the owners and prospective investors in stock in the company can ask themselves, is that a good return based upon the risk that is associated with the money being, with my money being invested in this company? Remember, because shareholders' equity is my money, money. My money, money. You know what I mean. My money, money. The total assets comprise debt holders' money and shareholders' money. But when you get down here to shareholders' equity and return on equity, that's owners saying, that's my money. Is this company generating net income that is commensurate with the risk I am bearing by putting my money, shareholders' equity, into that company? That's actually, in a way, a more important. I got to be careful here. Depends on who's paying my consulting bill here. But in a way, as far as an investment advisor goes, investment in stock goes, this guy right here, return on equity, is more important to me. It's more important to me to the extent that the total assets, that's telling me the return to both the shareholders and the debt holders. Me as an equity holder, God forgive me for saying this, but screw the debt holders. I need to know how well I am doing with respect to this investment. That is sometimes not such a good way to think about it, but that's the way it is. Okay. Now, I'm thinking here, I'm almost tempted. I think I'm going to go to the liquidity ratios next. Fail. Although last year I did have someone who had the X-Files theme song. That was a win. Creeped the hell out of me, you know. But let me do. There's one of the ratios, as I cautioned you, there are ratios that I use as a financial analyst that the book doesn't. Now, I don't go through, there are actually literally dozens of ratios. I'm going to give you a couple that aren't in the book that I use because they're just so important to me. And definitely one, and it's right here in this set of ratios. Now, that was the profitability ratios. These are the liquidity ratios. The liquidity ratios. Now, just to start the ball rolling, is I'll give you a one term here, net working capital. I'm trying to be a little careful with my terminology. Net working capital would be current assets minus current liabilities. Okay, in other words, how much money do you have left over short term after you would satisfy all of your short-term bills, all your short-term liabilities? That term, the net working capital, you'll hear me use that term several times. Even in one of the very last lectures of the course, we return to the subject of net working capital in a topic called working capital management. But for now, just know that that's what I mean by net working capital. But I'm going to give you the first traditional ratio, the current ratio. The current ratio is your current assets over your current liabilities. This would essentially, now, let me caution you. Those profitability ratios, I'm glad I remembered this. Those will all come out as percentages. Those are percentages. Okay, they'll come out as decimals. You times them by 100, and you get a percent. Okay, so be sure that when you are doing a quiz or an exam of mine, you put the right essentially unit of measure on an answer. That is crucial. So if you're doing a profitability ratio, you should be coming up with a percentage. Here, that thing is a factor. It has a time sign behind it. It measures how many times over your current assets can cover your current liabilities. How many times over your current assets can cover your current liabilities? Now, in the simple world of the early part of this course, I'd say, obviously, you want that number to be higher than one. Actually, you don't necessarily have to. It depends upon your working capital management policy. But as a good starting point, you would surely want to have your current assets be able to cover your current liabilities at least one time over if you had to. In other words, if all of your current liabilities came due, how many times over could your current assets pay them? So we could have the current assets, for example, at... Let me do a quick little thing. Cash and marketable securities. Let's say that that's $50,000. Let's say your accounts receivable, your ARs are, let's say, $25,000. Let's say that your inventory is, let's do $45,000 on that. So your total current assets, and this is just a simple one, total current assets are, $110,000. Now let's say that your current liabilities, let's make it simple, your current liabilities are, I can do that. See, I just wanted to see if you could actually work that. I so suck at arithmetic. Anyway, your current liabilities. Let's say your notes payable is are $40,000. Your accounts payable are, $20,000. And so your total current liabilities, and I'm just throwing some quick numbers in here just to write it for you, are $60,000. So your current ratio in this case would be $120,000 divided by $60,000, which equals 2.0. After that, you write an X times. In other words, my current assets can pay my current liabilities two times over. And also, with respect to these ratios, if it's a percentage, give it to me to two decimal places as a percentage. So in other words, you calculate it out to four decimal places, and then when you turn it into a percentage, it will be two decimal places. That is a requirement. Rock solid. Two decimal places for a percentage. Now, typically, I wrote that as one. The same would apply here. I would usually want two, but sometimes if it's a solid number, I'll just put a 2.0 for multipliers, for factors. Now, the next one is called the quick ratio. You're not going to hear me call it that because in my world, especially in the older world, we call it the acid test. This is the acid test. You take your current assets and then you say, yeah, really, if I were to have to liquidate fast, I would get diddly squat for my inventory. I might be able to have some odd lots or Kmart buy it up real fast, but really, I'm going to get pennies on the dollar for my inventory. So I'm going to take that out and see what I really could generate in cash without worrying about trying to sell my inventory, which would be the most illiquid of my current assets. I couldn't sell that on a dime, and even when I did sell it, I wouldn't get a whole lot for my inventory, especially if it was at some intermediate stage of production. So I take current assets minus inventory over current liabilities, and that gives me what we call the acid test. You can call it the quick ratio as you wish. That's new age. In my world, we call it the acid test. And so the acid test here would be to say that I have $120,000 less my inventory, which was $45,000, and divide that by my $60,000. And that would come up with, and I'm going to use my calculator so that I don't even try to make a disgrace myself with the wrong answer. 120 minus 45 divided by 60, 1.25. And again, that's a times. Without inventory, if I couldn't sell my inventory fast, I can still cover my current liabilities 1.25 times over with my more liquid assets. You will notice, of course, that you should have the quick ratio below the current ratio. One of the interesting things is to keep an eye on the balance between these two. If you're looking from year to year at a company, look at the behavior, not just of the current ratio, not just of the acid test, but look at how they move relative to each other through time. Do they get closer together? Do they get further apart? What's happening between them? Now for one that's not in the book, one that is actually almost logical. And I don't know if there's actually a technical term. I've forgotten years ago. We call the quick ratio the acid test. Its technically correct name is quick ratio. I swear I can't remember if there is actually a technical name for this one. We always call it the burn test. Where I come from, in my day, we called it the burn test. The burn test is where all you look at is your cash and marketable securities over your current liabilities. In other words, with the burn test, you're saying, really, we're not going to get rid of this stuff. If we had to get our current liabilities paid today, we're not going to be able to get money from anything but our bank accounts. Really. So this burn test essentially tells you the last rung of the company's, if it was in a really, really desperate situation. And if you look at the burn test on this company, the burn would be $50,000 over $60,000. So in an absolute crisis circumstance, no, $50,000 over $60,000, I'm not even going to try it. It irritates the hell out of me. $50,000 divided by 60. I knew that. 83.83 times. So this company, if it came down to pull the money out of the bank to pay off all your liabilities, current liabilities, this company couldn't do it. Couldn't cover them all. That's not a bad thing. It's just looking at it from a crisis standpoint. As a matter of fact, I recall, it's been years ago, I knew a treasurer of a company. His whole theory was, I will never let a burn go below 1.00. He said, that way I know we will always live through any day that ever comes at us. So he said everything with this as the pivot, the burn, and then the quick and the current floated above it. But a lot of companies wouldn't even think about this day, and a lot of companies don't even calculate the burn test anymore. But still, for my purposes, I would ask you about it, just so I can push that forward, this idea that this is sort of like the crisis liquidity measure, the burn is. It tells you how many times over you could pay your current liabilities with just pulling money out of the bank on the day that the crisis happened. How often that would actually occur in a company, that's another thing entirely. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm trying to think of how I want to order. I'm looking at some of my notes here on this. I'm thinking, yeah, I think I'll do the efficiency ratios next. And I've got, here we go. Here we go again. Let me look at something. I called them efficiency. Now, be careful. The book will use the term asset activity ratios. You'll hear me sometimes, I just did it there, that's why I'm being so concerned about my notes here, is I commonly call these efficiency ratios. They're efficiency ratios, but you will hear them called the asset activity ratios. And I'm going to give you, just throw a couple of asset activity ratios at you here, just to give you a kind of an idea of what these are all about. Yep. I sure did. I called them efficiency ratios because that's how I call them. Shoot. Oh, well. Inventory. Well, how would I want to do this? Inventory turnover ratio. Let me just do it this way. Cost of goods sold. Over inventory, COGS over inventory. That's how I'll put it that way. This essentially is telling us how quickly the company is moving its inventory, how fast the company is moving its inventory. This number, I can't tell you whether this number should be high or low. It depends upon the theory of inventory management, which to some extent is beyond the scope of this course, but I will give you this word on inventory management. There are fads that go through management. I mean, you get, ever since I've been in academia as an undergrad and then a grad, then a consultant and all that kind of stuff, there have been fads coming and going. One big fad that hit in the 1980s, really, and then it was picked up a lot of steam in the 1990s, was what came to be known as just-in-time inventory management. A way by which you had virtually no inventory in stock at any time. You set, essentially, when you needed, like a car company, a car manufacturer needed a car door, it would simply go to the supplier and say, get us a car door right now. And so you effectively had inventory management that was stripped down to virtually no inventory at all. So your inventory number was very small compared to your COGS. So inventory turnover was a sky-high number. Now, this idea came from the Japanese. Japanese car manufacturers were very much into this kind of way of doing their inventory management. This just-in-time, I'm trying to remember, what the heck was the other term they used back in the time for it? Just-in-time was one of them. Anyway, one way or the other. You know, it sounds like a really great idea because essentially you don't have any inventory. You're not using up your money in keeping inventory, keeping buildings with inventory. You essentially just bring things in as you need them to manufacture the product as you produce it. Now, that sounds like a great idea. So you saw kind of in manufacturing, inventory turnover ratios going up, especially in the 1990s. And in the 2000s, it was just like, well, the Japanese do it. The Japanese beat our asses at a lot of things. So let's do this the way the Japanese do. Well, here's the problem with what happened with this. There were actually a couple of massive problems that showed up. One of them was that the companies manufacturing, auto manufacturing companies, essentially told the suppliers, you need to move your facilities so that you form essentially a physical ring around us so that when we need a car bumper, it's you're right there, you can get it to us right away. And so essentially you created what was essentially like a vertical assembly line of the central company that was building the final product and all of its suppliers of the intermediate products around it like a ring. Well, here was the problem with that. What happens when the central company screws the pooch and dies because of its own stupid management, which is exactly what happened with some of our auto manufacturers over the last couple of years? They died, the core rotted, and then the ring died around them because it was too close to them and it had become completely dedicated to servicing their needs. And when the central organism died, it created a cascade effect that was even stronger than it would have been. It certainly would have been there, but it was even stronger than it would have been because these companies essentially turned themselves into nothing but satellites of the core auto manufacturer. So that just in time, great idea until it's not a good idea. So just because you see a high cost of goods sold to inventory does not necessarily mean that's a, wow, they're really turning over that inventory. They're saving a lot of space for inventory. They're really doing good. Not necessarily. Think about the consequences of that. If their inventory ratio, turnover ratio is too high, could they actually lower it and reduce the risk to themselves and to their suppliers?
Okay, enough of that one. I'm not going to go through days inventory outstanding, but I will do one here. And this one's just an abstract. You won't be tested on this because it's a little hard in financial statements these days to see credit sales. But there's one that I always bring up here. It's average collection period.
The average collection period. Now, the average collection period is your accounts receivable divided by your credit sales over 360. And again, I'm not going to ask about this one. I wouldn't do this one on a test or anything. The problem is, like I said, it's kind of hard nowadays in financial statements, especially in rough form financial statements or summary financial statements, to see your credit sales. But it's one that for you to think about. How short is their collection period? Now, again, this is one where you would think, well, maybe the smaller the average collection period is, the better, right? Obviously, a company that has an average collection period of 12 days would be superior to a company that has an average collection period of 25 days because obviously they're not extending credit for as long. That's not necessarily correct because I will tell you this right now. That if I am a business person and I have had a company extend credit to me and then they come hopping at my door beating me up so that they can have their average collection period go down, 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 I'll drop them like a hot potato. No, stop bugging me. You'll get your money, you asshole. But not now. You see, trying to drive this number down actually could be a sign that the company that's driving it down is hard up for cash and it's beating everyone up. It's no longer extending credit as long or as or on as favorable terms. That can be a bad sign that the company is getting kind of desperate for money. If the same company that used to, and this is actually something that happened to me just recently, the same company that didn't even bother me, for it would just say, pay us within 21 days, now is hopping up and down, this is due right now. The first thing I do is say, screw you, I'll work with someone else on my business, because I'm not going to pay you right now, because there's a company over here that's still extending 21 days or even 14 days of credit, so no. And the other thing that I ask is, why are you so desperate for cash? Why are you dancing on one leg like you got to pee? What's the problem here? You see what I'm saying is, what I'm trying to convey here is that when you look at these numbers, there's no hard and fast. Be a cynical bastard like me. But either way it goes, it's not a celebration until I'm sure that it really is good news. Well, the collection period went down. That might be good news, but it might also be a bad sign. And that's true with all of these ratios. Favorable movement of a ratio might not be for favorable reasons.
Oh, a mother's work is never done. I don't know. Fixed asset turnover.
I'm trying to make a logical flow of these, and really, there's almost like no logical way that of progression.
Fixed asset turnover, sales over fixed assets.
Now, what this means, or in some cases, sales over long-term assets. In this course, by the way, I don't make the long-term assets a complex part of the balance sheet. It usually comprises just fixed assets. But what this does is says, all right, based upon my fixed assets, how many times is that money that is invested in fixed assets turning over in sales every year? So, for example, if I had sales of $5 million and I had fixed assets of $1 million, I would say that $1 million that I have put into fixed assets, I churned that five times. It made five times as much as there is in the money in the fixed assets. This one will be a times number. This one will be a times number. Just like the inventory turnover. Those are factors. So 5 million in sales divided by 1 million in fixed assets, that's five times over I used my fixed assets value to create revenue. Again, I used my fixed asset value to create five times over that amount of money in value of revenue. It's an important number. Again, though, caution. Sounds like the higher the number, the better the number, right? The more times you turn over your fixed assets, the better. Again, caution. It could be the case that the company, if it does not reinvest and put in new fixed assets, it could, for a period of years, just keep getting sales to go up and up and up on the same fixed asset base. But in the end, that is a fool's gambit. And I'll tell you an industry where that happened. It's the American oil refining industry. Did you know that in the United States there has not been an oil refinery built in over 20 years? Over 20 years. So you're going to see a fixed asset turnover ratio going through the roof on a company, on those kinds of companies that refine oil. You see it? The fixed asset base stays the same. If not, it goes down through depreciation to virtually zero on a financial statement, and the sales go up and up and up, so the fixed asset turnover just keeps getting higher and higher and higher. Looks great, doesn't it? until your oil refineries just start exploding because you've worn them out, you've burned them up, you've destroyed the fixed asset by using it too much without reinvestment, without technological improvements, which is exactly what's happened. You remember in the last few years, the oil refineries that have blown up in Texas and all that, seemed like there for a while, every week on the news, you got to see Texas oil men flying through the air. It was pretty cool. And that was just the reality of it. You don't put more money into fixed assets. Sure, for a period of time, you can just keep milking those for higher and higher sales. But sooner or later, the fixed assets will give up. They'll just say FTS. Fancy that scenario. They just won't be able to handle it anymore. So be cautious. Again, higher, better. Not if it is going to just keep going higher and higher and higher at the expense of investment in new fixed assets and all of the things that would be brought forward later from investing in new fixed assets. Sometimes you have to see a company take a breath, backing down on the fixed asset turnover. Just because the fixed asset turnover falls isn't a bad sign. It could be a sign that management has determined we need to put big new money into our company, into our fixed asset base, so that then we can step forward with all this new equipment, new technology, and make even better sales down the road. And as a matter of fact, I recall it was last year, I wasn't even expecting it. The financials that I gave of the company to the students last year, that actually happened. You saw the fixed asset ratio fall. But if you look forward in time, that was an investment in lots of new buildings and new kinds of equipment. And then, sure enough, sales started to respond nicely in the years that came after that. Total asset turnover, of course. Total asset turnover would be sales over total assets. Same essential thing. It's a factor. You find the number to two decimal places and put an X after it to represent times. It just tells you how many times over your total assets are generating revenue for the company. Same essential thing. Now, I don't think this one is in the book, but there's another one that I kind of like myself. This is the only other one that I'll push that's not in the book, I think. Working capital turnover. I don't recall this one being in your textbook, but working capital turnover. And it's essentially your sales over your working capital. Sales over net working capital. You'll have to forgive me, I don't recall this one. And sometimes it's just working capital. I use net working capital. It's a number that it basically tells you what your excess of current assets over current liabilities is doing to create sales. It's an oddball, and I don't know that I would be able to explain it in just a time frame of a lecture like this. I would encourage you, you'd have to, if you took me for a more advanced course, I would definitely beat on this one for a while, but it's kind of hard to explain what it's about here. But it does have a very important use, and it conforms with what we'll talk about at the end of this course, where we talk about working capital management. Essentially, in a way, it tells you what your highly liquid asset base is doing to create sales. Your highly liquid asset base is doing to create sales. And it's hard to explain it exactly, but it's very sensitive to fluctuations in cash, accounts receivable, inventory, and things like that. It's also very sensitive to how much you are relying on short-term borrowings in the company. is a very sensitive measure of what we call leverage. Because if you look at the working capital, and I promised that I was not going to do this, but I am going to just for a minute. If you look at net working capital, you take current liabilities away from current assets. Well, current liabilities have your short-term borrowings in them, okay? So if your short-term borrowings go up against your current assets, that would make your net working capital get smaller. You see that? As you borrowed more short-term, your net working capital could shrink. If you're not putting that that short-term borrowing into short-term assets, but you're putting it into long-term. So essentially, in one kind of working capital management theory, you borrow short, but put it into longer-term assets. So that what happens is that this gets closer to zero, the net working capital does. But what that does over here is that makes the denominator of this get closer to zero, so that sales over that number closer to zero goes up. So in a way, it shows how much your short-term borrowings to invest, to put into long-term assets, is paying off in terms of higher sales. Again, I'm almost sorry I started this one up, but it's just one of those that's out there, and I'll bring it up at the end of the course again. And again, I am so sorry I brought that one up. Leverage ratios, the biggies, the leverage ratios. Now, when I say leverage, that's my marker. Okay, now let me see if I can do this. Damn. Pisses me off. Okay. Not much, right? When I pull from here. Now, if I can get this to work, and of course, if I didn't want this to work, I'd probably hurt something I care about. Ow, God, never mind. The hell with that example, these tables are too heavy. Leverage. A couple of years ago, I was trying to do that, and I was sitting on one of the desks, and the other one was right there, and it pinched me so bad, I was actually limping for the rest of the class. Leverage simply is a term we use in finance for the amount of debt we are using and how that magnifies something else. Leverage is just sort of like a term that we use to talk about how debt magnifies something else. Whether that something else is a sales figure or whether it's a return on equity, leverage is simply a sort of a term for a magnification caused by debt. So when I'm talking about leverage ratios, I'm looking at the core where this starts. Now, one of the leverage ratios, the biggie, is debt to equity. Or debt to total assets. So let me write debt to total assets first. Although the other one, debt to equity, is more popular to use, debt to total assets is simply your debt over your total assets. And you would say, well, duh. Just be cautious on a financial statement. The debt, you look at your long-term debt, but also look up to see if there's any debt that is hanging in notes payable. And I recall it was distinctly, last year I was attacking Amazon.com, and it worked just looking at the long-term debt for the numerator of this. And then in the last year, I almost screwed up because I didn't notice that Amazon, out of nowhere, had suddenly started taking on short-term debt, which it hadn't done before. I think that was how it worked. But my ratio for the last year, I almost calculated it wrong because I didn't notice that there was a little bit of the notes payable were showing up in the total debt structure of the company. Now, this total debt to total assets will be a percentage. It will be a percentage. It will be between 0 and 100%. Now, every company out there that's worth its salt will have a target of what is called an optimal capital structure. An optimal capital structure. That is essentially the same as saying, what is the best in terms of the weighted average cost of the capital? What is the best balance between debt and equity? This is one way to look at the optimal capital, to look at the capital structure. I might say, okay, we've determined that the optimal capital structure of this corporation would be 40% debt. In that way, I would be talking about the debt to total assets ratio. If we talk about the optimal capital structure in terms of a percentage of debt in the capital structure. The other one that is also popular is called the debt to equity measure. Debt to equity. And that is the debt over the shareholders' equity. Now, this number could vary between 0 and infinity. Is that right? Yeah, 0 and infinity. And that's why I kind of don't like this number. Although everyone says debt to equity. What's the debt equity ratio? I'm not as favorable to it, and it just kind of sticks in my craw because the number could be, you see, if you have no equity, your company is all debt, the number, the debt to equity ratio would be infinity. And whenever I play with infinity, it just worries me. I don't know what to say about that. So in a way, even though debt to equity is the more popular term, well, what's your debt equity ratio? I understand that that can be a number that's really weird. If you've got like $9 million in debt and $1 million in equity, your debt equity ratio is 9.00 times. And if it's $9,999,000 of debt, over 1,000 of equity, this number gets even more ridiculous. So these highly, highly leveraged companies, which are still out there, and they were certainly around in big time in previous years, their debt equity ratios were just these ginormous numbers. That's why I'm more comfortable with the debt to total assets ratio. So when you hear me talk about optimal capital structure, more likely you'll hear me talk about it as a percentage, so you would know that I'm talking about the debt to total assets and not the debt to equity ratio. The last one that is, there's one more that isn't in the book, but I don't think I'll do that one this time. But here's the last one, the times interest earned. The times interest earned. It's the EBIT over the interest. So in other words, if we were driving down, we got earnings before interest and taxes was, let's say, $400,000. And the interest expense of the company was $100,000 to get our EBT of $300,000, the times interest earned would in that case be obviously $400,000 over $100,000. Now let me point out something here, 4.00 times. That says that this company can pay with the money that is available to pay it. This company can pay its interest four times over. Now, here's the theory. This number should not be too high, and it obviously should not be too low. If this number is below 1, that means that it's technical default. You see that? I mean, if it's below 1, the company can't pay its interest, bondholders come in, and they kick the management's ass out the door, and all bets are off. So obviously, you don't want it to be below 1. That's your sort of your limit. But the idea that the higher, the better, not always. Not always. Here's the deal. Now, I brought up Amazon.com last time. Its times interest rate was just up in the stratosphere. It's a great company. So I qualify what I'm about to say by pointing out, well, yeah, there are companies that have very high times interest earned. There's nothing wrong with them. But here's the deal. If you've got so much money at the EBIT line, but you have hardly any interest to pay, well, that's great in a way. But the next thing I would ask you is, you don't have a whole lot of debt in this company's capital structure, do you? No, we don't. We're very proud of that. Okay, so you're mostly equity, right? Yes, we believe in the old-fashioned neither a borrower nor a lender be. We don't use debt, hardly at all. But equity is extraordinarily expensive compared to debt in a cost of capital sense. Debt is actually very cheap compared to equity in terms of cost of capital. So you, by being this way, you are giving up the gains that you could get through cheaper capital if you were to use more debt and less equity. And you would also be doing your owners, your shareholders, a favor. If you get too much debt, you get into danger, obviously, of default, cash flow fluctuation. But at the same time, you're doing expensive as hell capital. And it's expensive for a couple of reasons. Here are the reasons why equity, and we get into this big time in this course, and this is where I like to do these windows on what we're going to do. Here's the deal. There are a couple of reasons that equity is extraordinarily expensive compared to debt. One is, you're a shareholder in a corporation. You're going to get yours last. You get the crust of bread after the debt holders have been paid. Does that mean that your position is less risky or more risky than the debt holders? More. So, by one of the first principles I taught you in finance, do you expect a lower return or do you expect a higher return? Bingo. So the equity holders are going to expect a higher return on their investment. There is the first reason that equity is a more costly form of capital than debt. Now, here's the other thing. What comes right after EBT on the financial statements? Taxes. Oh, well, spank me, Jesus. You get to deduct your interest before you pay your taxes. You don't get to do that with dividends. Interest is tax deductible. That makes it even cheaper as a cost. Equity. You don't get any slack. You pay your taxes, then you pay your dividends to your shareholders. So that means that you've got a double whammy of why equity is more expensive. One is equity is riskier to the investors, so I have to they expect a higher return. That's the first reason it's more expensive. Second, interest is tax deductible. So I get a bargain thanks to the IRS. From the money that I borrow. I get a coupon that I don't get with equity investors. So when that company comes to me and says, well, we've got a great times interest earnings, it's way up there, way up in the air, I ask them, okay, that's great. God love you, that's the old-fashioned Calvinist way, no debt, and be self-reliant and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you are paying out the wazoo for not using some leverage in your capital structure. Okay? Now, on Monday, we will do a real-life fire company. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.